Hi everyone, thanks for coming. This feels excessive, but it's for the camera, so ignore the microphone. So today we're lucky to have Anne Candler come to talk. She's in town for Michael's PAC committee, but because she's so well suited to the aims of the collective behaviour cluster, we thought it would be great to combine her visit with a collective behaviour cluster seminar. So Anne's a group leader at MPI Leipzig, where she works on questions of cultural evolution and modeling cultural evolution in populations. And she did her PhD in Germany, and not in German.
Also in German.
Was it? Wasn't,
yes.
Was it? Shockingly, in German. Before moving to the UK, where she was a postdoc at UCL with Kevin Leyland and James Steele, where she then stayed on to do a fellowship before taking up a lectureship at University of London. Is that right? And did a brief stint at Santa Fe as well, working there, before coming back to Germany to take up this position at MPI Leipzig just a couple of years ago, I think. So, yeah. And she's going to talk to us today about inferring social learning from population level data. So.
Okay, cool. So thanks, Lucy, for this kind of introduction. Also, thanks for inviting me to speak at this kind of seminar series. So today's talk is about inferring processes of social learning from cultural frequency data. Okay. So, maybe just laying some ground at the beginning that we all kind of are on the same page. So in the following, we're going to assume that social learning and cultural transmission is defined as learning that is facilitated by observations of or interactions with another individual or its product. Just the normal or the kind of relatively standard definition by now. But we all know that social learning is not a single unique process. To the contrary, I think in the literature there have been defined a huge number of different ways of how we can learn socially. So for instance, Qualis-Forza and Feldman, they defined so-called learning pathways or learning modes. And here they distinguish between vertical, horizontal, and oblique transmission, where vertical transmission is simply the transmission from parent to offspring. Horizontal transmission, the transmission between peers, so within the same age group. And oblique transmission, transmission from individuals of an older age group to individuals of a younger age group, so kind of a teacher-pupil relationship. So those transmission pathways, they kind of reduce the pool of potential learning partners, but they don't tell us yet from which individual to learn or which cultural variant actually to adopt. So and this job is done by so-called learning biases, and this is a scheme I have taken from a review paper by Luke Randall et al. And all what it's supposed to show you is that there have been a huge number of those different social learning biases identified in the literature. So humans can have a, let's say, a conformist bias, we can have a prestige bias, we can have a pro-novelty bias, and in different contexts we might kind of express different of those kind of biases. And kind of given you know, the sheer variety of those different social learning biases or social learning modes, understanding how and also when social information is used has become one of the challenges in cultural evolution. And a huge amount of work, mainly experimental, empirical, also theoretical work, has been dedicated to this question. Maybe just as a little overview, to be a little bit more precise, research to establish the presence of a particular learning strategy in human populations. So in the following, I'm going to actually only talk about human population, have centered around laboratory-based approaches with micro-society and diffusion chain approaches, inference-based approaches, and modeling-based approaches. All of these three areas are really vibrant fields of research, and they're only some of the key papers on this slide. And for the purpose of this talk, let's have a little bit closer look at modeling-based approaches. And here, especially the research groups led by Rob Boyd and Peter Richardson and Mike Feldman have developed a really beautiful body of theoretical work, which is mainly aimed at understanding the evolutionary advantage or disadvantage of social learning over its counterpart, asocial learning or individual learning. And this kind of theoretical models, they have provided us with important insights into which social learning strategies are expected in population especially in spatially and temporally changing environments, at equilibrium. But what's often relatively tough to is to kind of relate the theoretical results to actual empirical empirical estimates. So what we don't have yet are information about the strategies human population actually use based on the empirical evidence, at least outside any laboratory conditions. So, and this is where we like to add something to the field. What we would like to develop is a framework that attempts to infer a process of social learning directly from available data without any equilibrium or optimality assumption. Because the question when a cultural system is at equilibrium is something which is usually relatively tough to answer. But if we pose our question in this way, of course the next question is, well, what's available data? So in a lot of archaeological, anthropological, also modern contexts, what we have are population-level frequencies detailing the usage or occurrence of different variant of a cultural trait at one or different points in time. So this is data we often have, so population-level data. And this kind of faces us with the following problem. We assume that we can observe population-level frequency of different variants of a cultural trait. And as is by now widely accepted, that processes of social learning can be one of the main causes of cultural change, with cultural change simply being defined as a temporal change in frequency of different cultural variants, we aim to infer those underlying processes of social learning that generated those observable patterns. Now, this is a very nice aim to have, but whether we can actually achieve this is a completely different question. Because we are actually posed with a classical inverse problem. We can observe only population-level patterns, but from those population-level patterns, we would like to infer, you know, the underlying processes. And whether this is ill or well-posed, it's not clear from the beginning, especially we have seen that there are a lot of different a lot of candidates for those underlying processes of social transmission. So the question, what we actually want to ask in this talk is, how much information about underlying process of social learning can actually be inferred from population level data? So the data which is readily available. So we're going to do that in three parts. First, we ask about expectation. We ask, what should researchers expect to be able to infer? Second, we ask, what happens when we actually have a potentially sparse data set? What are frameworks that allow us to make those inferences? And the last, we ask whether having big data, having a kind of data with a good temporal resolution, does it free us from all the trouble which we're going to identify along the way? Okay, let's start with the first question. What should researchers expect to be able to infer? So to answer that one, we constructed a very simplistic simulation framework. And this framework assumes that we have a number of individuals, and all of those individuals possess a variant of a cultural trait. Now, on each time step, individuals can age, they can reproduce, and they can die with a certain probability. All naive, kind of newborn individuals, they inherit their first cultural variant from their parents via vertical transmission. But further, with a certain probability, individuals can engage in additional social transmission events during their lifetime. So in this kind of social learning is again modeled incredibly simplistically. We just simply assume an individual chooses randomly an interaction partner from a specific pool of individuals and adopts this cultural variance with a probability 1 minus mu. And with mu, it just simply adopts something else. So in this pool of individuals, or the size of this pool, this determines our different kind of learning modes we want to distinguish. As we already have seen, in the case of vertical transmission, well, the pool is only our parent. If we have horizontal transmission, it's all the individuals within the same age group. If we have oblique transmission, it's everyone older than us. And then we have also an age-neutral condition. This is all individuals of the population, so we can basically copy or learn from everyone. So what this simulation framework allows to do, it allows us to track the distribution. It allows us to track the distribution of variants of our cultural trait across the population over time, but importantly, condition on a specific learning mode. And there we distinguish between vertical, horizontal, oblique, and age-neutral learning, and their frequency-dependent counterparts. So now our simulation framework gives us, you know, artificial data, but based on a specific learning mode. And then we can ask, well, based on the data we have, can we actually find statistics so that we can distinguish between those learning modes? So this is the aim of this framework. And maybe also just a word on why we've chosen something so simplistic. So it should be stressed that this is not replicating any real-world scenario, of course. But the idea was, if we are not able to distinguish between these different transmission modes in this very simplistic setting, we probably should not expect to do so in a much more complex situation. Okay, so now we look at two data situations. The first data situation is that we assume that we only have data at a single point in time, something which is occurs very often in anthropological research. So, and for this data situation, we use four statistics. The frequency of the most common cultural variants, the total number of variants in the population, the level of cultural diversity, and the full information, meaning the frequency of all cultural variants in the population. Now, the reason why we look at those four statistics is that we just want to mimic different data situations. We want to ask, okay, how does our inferential power changes if you let's have only information about the total number as opposed to a situation where we actually have all information about the composition of the population at a specific point in time. So then we also assume that we have kind of time series data. And we just try to describe this dynamic of cultural change by assessing the average time a cultural variant stays the most common variant. This is a bit of an odd measure, but again, we try to build something parsimonious because empirical researchers probably will not have kind of information about the full time series at every point in time. So what we thought is that, well, maybe information about the most common variant is something what they can provide, or at least what they can estimate. So now, what our simulation framework allows us to do, it allows us to generate distributions of those observable statistics under different social learning modes. And then we can just simply ask, well, how different are those distributions? And we quantify the level of difference by calculating the area of overlap between those two distributions. So if they are almost the same, the area of overlap is of course almost one. If those distributions are very different, the overlap is then almost zero. And in this situation, we can actually say that those two transmission modes can be reliably distinguished based on the statistic we have at hand. So now if you have even an empirical estimate for this particular statistic, we can even be a bit more precise. We can actually calculate the probability that this estimate has been generated by one social learning mode as opposed by the other. So in some sense, we can, with this relatively simple model, we can develop general expectation about the level of distinguishability, of course, always only based on the model we have set up. So I'm going to show you just some very, very few results of this exercise. First, the result is that if you have a situation of slow cultural change, meaning there are also only very few opportunities for social learning during an individual's lifetime, then we should not expect to be able to distinguish between our transmission mode on any statistic. So, and what you see here is the numbers, it's just the area of overlap between all of those kind of pairwise comparison. Black means it's almost close to one, white means it's close to zero. And here we have our information at a particular point in time, and we see, well, nothing can be done. The situation doesn't look much better if we have temporal variation, everything is kind of gray, we still have quite a substantial overlap. Things look a little bit better if you have a situation of fast cultural change, meaning individuals have more opportunities for social learning during their lifetime. Then we can actually reliably distinguish between our transmission modes, at least when we have some idea about the temporal dynamic. But again, if we only have static information at a single point in time, then the level of distinguishability is relatively poor. And this is based on knowing the complete composition of the population, and those numbers are even lower, as expected, for all other statistics. Maybe just a little mention. Often it is stated that the presence of conformity in a population can be detected by relatively low levels of cultural diversity in this population. So we just simply ask, like, okay, is it actually true? If we have a level of cultural diversity, can we distinguish between our horizontal, oblique, and age-neutral transmission and their frequency-dependent counterparts? And the result is, well, if we have only information at a single point in time, we cannot distinguish or we cannot detect the presence of weak or medium-sized conformist transmission in the population. As you clearly see here, the overlap is still close to one. And we also see that effects of drift further hinder our ability to detect conformity. Again, measures of cultural change save the day. So if we actually have an idea of how fast the dynamic of cultural change is progressing, then we can reliably detect the presence of at least medium and strong conformist bias in the population. So you see here some of those overlaps, they are actually even zero, meaning that those distributions are completely set apart. So this is just to give you some idea of how such a simple simulation framework is actually able to potentially guide our expectations of what we should be able to say based on the data we are having. There are more results about that. However, I just want to wrap this question quickly up. I hope I could show you that social learning modes can only be inferred if cultural change actually happens. And that sounds like a very trivial point. However, if you only have data at a single point in time, it's not obvious when this is the case. If we have only data at a single point in time, then we, of course, should try to get as much as possible, because if we only know how many variants there are, well, the power of distinguishability is incredibly low. And if possible, then we should put any inference framework based on the temporal dynamic, because this signature, the temporal change, just has the largest signature about the underlying process of social learning. So what we can say from this little exercise is that precise inference results can often not be guaranteed based on population level properties of the population, and therefore showing the consistency of a single learning hypothesis observed data might often not be enough if you have such equifinal data situation. Okay, so let's move to the second question. This has received much more attention in the literature. So we now assume that we actually have some data and want to infer something from this data set. And on the following, I'm going to focus on a so-called generative inference framework, which has been already very successfully applied in genetics. And such a framework consists of two main parts. The first is a generative model, which should be designed as a potentially non-equilibrium framework capturing the main cultural and demographic dynamics of the cultural system. But importantly, this generative model has to produce data very similar to the data that can be observed. So in our situation, it has to produce frequency changes of different cultural variants present in a population under a specific assumed learning hypothesis. So in other words, our generative model is supposed to hypothesize our causal relationship between our learning processes on the one hand and observable patterns of frequency change on the other. So and then in the second step, we have to make a statistical comparison which will allow us for conclusions about which potentially mixtures of learning processes are consistent with the observable frequencies and maybe more importantly, which are not. So, and as already said, this framework, there are no new inventions. They have been already very successfully applied in genetics, and we hope they will have a similar success in cultural evolution. And to make the whole thing a little bit less theoretical, I would like to walk you through an analysis of a specific data set. So we're going to look at this archaeological data set, which describes pretty much the culture of the early farmers in Southwest Germany. So it contains frequency of vessels decorated with specific motifs from excavated settlements of the first farmer in Southwest Germany. So in this situation, the cultural trade are different pots, and the different variants of this cultural trade are those different motifs on those pots. And the data that we are having are the frequencies of those different motifs at the beginning and then the end of seven different phases. And importantly, those seven different phases are excavations taken at the same site, so kind of a social learning story actually makes sense. So just again, data what we have, frequencies of different cultural variants at the beginning and at the end of seven different phases. And the question that archaeology actually posed were precisely, what are the underlying social learning processes that produce those changes between the beginning and the end? So, and for more historical reasons, archaeologists are mainly interested in neutral evolution, so unbiased transmission, frequency-dependent biases, the form of conformity and anti-conformity, and in a pro-novelty bias. So we're going to design a generative kind of framework which kind of captures all those three transmission modes. Okay, let's do that. This is the outline of our generative model, and we run already in the very first problem because what we have are actually sample frequencies. But every evolutionary process acts on the population level. So the first step our generative model has to do is go somehow from sample to population. So in order to do that, we take the following approach. First, we assume that we have a sample, and the sample has k cultural variants. And these variables ni just give me the absolute abundance of those variants in our sample. Now we ask the question, what are population structures from which my sample could have been drawn with a positive probability? And this population structure now consists of K plus one variant. And this K plus one contains everything not observed in the sample. So everything what our sample procedures could likely have missed. So, and taking or making use of the Circle-Dirichlet distribution after some algebra, we arrive at this kind of distribution. And then sampling from this distribution really generates us population structures from which our sample could have been drawn with a positive probability. So this is the first step up, or a step down. We kind of gone from here to here. Now we have potential population structures at the beginning of the phase, consistent with our sample. And now we have to somehow transform our population at the beginning of the phase into a population at the end of the phase, conditioned on a specific process of social learning. And in order to do that, we have to do some assumption, and all of those assumptions are kind of archaeology inspired. First, we assume that the sample size is a fraction of the population size. Now, this has been done because my archaeology collaborator assured me that there's very good reason to believe that at this specific site, roughly 10% of the population actually has been excavated. Then we assume that pottery is produced once a year. That means we actually know the number of production events. Also a very crucial assumption. And the last one, we assume that during each kind of production event, or during each year, only a certain fraction of the population of cultural variants is replaced. So only a certain number of vessels actually break and they have to be replaced. And this little r here is nothing else than kind of the average lifetime of an individual pot. So on whether this is 2, 5, or 10 years, so how clumsy they were, nobody knows. So that's why this is a parameter which is going to be inferred from the data as well. Okay, so how does it look like? It's pretty much nothing else than kind of a Markov chain approach. We want to transform a population at time point t in a population at time point t plus 1. So first we know that only a couple of our cultural variants are removed from the population, meaning that those guys are just simply present in the next time step. So the only question what we have to answer is, how do we replace the missing ones? And this is where our social learning comes into play, because replacement happens in according with the assumed process of social learning. If we assume neutral evolution or unbiased transmission, then we choose a variant for replacement simply according to its relative frequency. So this dot turns orange with roughly a probability of 3 over 11, blue with 6 over 11, and red with roughly 2 over 11. Mu again is our innovation rate with which we introduce something completely new into our system. So if you now would assume a frequency-dependent bias, so conformity, perhaps having a preference for kind of high frequency variants in the population, or anti-conformity, where we have a preference for low frequency variants in the population, we can use a similar approach, but just simply adding, you know, this selection term. In the case of conformity, this term in the brackets is positive if my variant has a high frequency. So, and then in this situation, the probability that this kind of variant type is chosen for replacement is just simply increased. Contrary, if my variant has a low frequency, then this term in the brackets becomes negative, and the probability that it's chosen for replacement is just simply decreased. So the strength of this selection is controlled by this parameter, and importantly, if our B is zero, then we just simply uncover unbiased transmission. So the same logic holds for pronullity bias. So if our variant is very young, so have been recently introduced, then this term in the brackets is going to be positive, and therefore the probability is increased. And again, our B is the strength of selection, and with B equals zero, we're just simply uncovering neutral evolution. Good, so almost done, because now we do that for each time point, and then we reach at the end of our phase, and the last step we have to do, we have to generate a sample. And we do this by kind of sampling from all of those theoretical population to include potential time averaging processes that usually occur in kind of archaeological data sets. And what we now have achieved is a sample, a theoretical sample conditioned on a specific process of social learning of the same size as our observed sample. And the nice thing also is that our process of social learning has been specified by our model parameter. So this is kind of this causal relationship between observable patterns of frequency change and the strength of our learning process in the population. So now we have to do the last step, and this is the statistical inference. Now we have to ask the question, okay, which of our learning processes are actually now able to produce theoretical data relatively close to the observed data? So this is done with some Bayesian inference technique called approximate Bayesian computation. And the idea here is beautifully simple. So what we just simply assume is some prior distribution for our model parameter. We sample from those prior distributions, we throw this parameter in our generative model, we run the generative model, we get a theoretical sample at the end. We compare the theoretical sample with our observed sample. If it's close enough, we keep this parameter set. If not, we just simply throw it away. So we repeat this many, many, many times in a kind of slightly more efficient way, and that generates us so-called posterior distributions. And we get posterior distributions for our selection strengths, but also for kind of our little r, the average lifetime of the individual pod. And those posterior distributions give me the range, or the range of my parameter set, which is able to produce theoretical data very close to my observed data. And now the width of those posterior distribution can actually be an indication of how much information can be extracted from our frequency data. So it can be kind of be an informal measure of equifinality. Let's take the good situation first. Our posterior distribution are super narrow. That means we can exclude a large space of, or a large part of the parameter space as not being able to produce theoretical data close to our observed data, at least based on our generative model. So in this situation, the data, the population level data, has relatively good signature about our underlying processes. But in the worst situation, if our posterior distributions are very wide, that means that actually almost the whole parameter space could produce the data which we actually have observed. In this situation, our data we have at hand doesn't carry a very strong signature about our underlying processes. So, and this is important that we identify those situations where our data doesn't carry much information about the question we asked, because either in those situations we have to well, look for different kinds of data, we have to ask different questions, because we will not be able to answer this kind of question with this kind of data. Okay, before we go to our LBK dataset back, just let me give you a proof of concept that what I've shown you could actually work. So for that, we just assumed we have a sample consisting of 7 variants with the frequency 1, 2, 5, 10, 20, 40, 60. We put this sample into our generative model. We run this model under different processes of social learning: anti-conformity, neutral, unbiased transmission, and conformity. Then we take the sample we take out, or we obtain after these 50 time points, and then we have kind of two theoretical kind of data points, and now we just simply throw them back in our generative inference framework and ask, how well do we recover the known selection strengths? And this is the answer. These are the posterior distribution for our selection strengths in those different situations. First, our true value is contained in all of those which has to be there by design. But what we see, and what's much more important, is that our posterior distribution actually has quite some width. So in this situation, we cannot distinguish between weak frequency-dependent selection and neutral evolution. It's just not possible based on only 2 time points. The same we see here. We can say it probably has been anti-conformist transmission, and it has not been, or there is no evidence for conformist transmission, but how strong this anti-conformity is, we actually simply have no idea. And the same happens in this situation. So what we see from here, there exist clear theoretical limits to the amount of information that can be extracted from sparse population level data. And this is not surprising, because we ask a lot from this little bit of data, but this problem of equifinality, we really have to take seriously. Okay, let's come back to our LBK data set. And when we applied our algorithm to it, what we actually could do is we could reject the hypothesis of unbiased transmission and frequency-dependent biases. We could simply reject it on the basis that none of those learning modes were able to produce theoretical data remotely close to our observed data. So in some sense, the error what we had was far too high. So, and this is one danger with applying those kind of ABC methods, because it will always produce a posterior distribution, but this posterior distribution is only then a good approximation of the underlying likelihood function if the error between theory and data is actually sufficiently small. If this error is big, throw it away, because this distribution should never be interpreted, because it just doesn't resemble the likelihood function. What we found was some evidence for consistency between pronovelty biases and our observed frequency changes. So, and importantly, I'm only talking about consistency. Think of all the other different social learning modes there are. What we have shown is that, well, this is one candidate that could have shaped the data, but probably not the only one. So just to show you some of the results, this is just the rows are different phases. The columns are different phases. Here we have our posterior distribution for the strengths of pro-novelty selection. The first, what we see is that the zero, which would indicate unbiased transmission, is not contained in the posterior distribution for any of our phases, meaning that pro-novelty selection can actually explain our observed frequency pattern better than unbiased transmission ever could. But we also see that those posterior distributions, they are pretty wide, but they are also relatively different between different phases. This is an example for a relative uninformative posterior distribution. That's our little r, the individual lifetime of a pod. And we see that, I think this was our prior distribution range, not much has been excluded. So in some sense, this is a situation where, well, the data doesn't has a lot of signature about how long an individual pod lives. We just can't make any inferences from that. So, and when we got these results, the archaeologists were actually pretty excited about it, because pro-novelty bias is something often talked in the context of fashion trends. So then we're saying, well, maybe the first farmers were not so different from us. They liked new things. They liked new patterns coming in every now and then. But again, everything what we have shown is consistency and not the kind of the true underlying evolutionary course. Okay, just to sum up this part, I hope I could convince you that this generative inference framework can be a pretty versatile tool for interpreting population level data, and particularly to assess the level of equifinality in the data. And this is something what we have to take very serious if you deal with those population level data and want to infer underlying processes. Just simply the question, can we do it? Or is the level of equifinality just too high that all the results we get are, well, in some sense meaningless? And for me, it is one of the strengths of those mathematical frameworks to help us understand the limits to inferring underlying processes from population level data. They help us identifying situations where we can do something or where we can infer something from population level data, and they help us identify a situation where this is just not the case, where we kind of need more detailed individual level data. And maybe the value of those frameworks lies not in saying this was precisely the evolutionary course. For me, the value in those frameworks lies in the exclusion of learning processes that could not have produced observed data. In that sense, we reduce the pool of potential hypotheses and also give an archaeologist a new discussion base, because we kind of like, okay, now this is what we can tease apart from this population level data. Maybe you have other kind of lines of evidence where you can say this is more likely than this. Anyway, so for me, the exclusion is one of the strong features how our this mathematical inference framework can help us with interpreting our population level data. Good. Last point. Do lots of data solve all our problems? And I take it away, the answer is unfortunately no. They kind of give us new problems. So if you want to have cultural data with a huge or with a good temporal resolution, the first candidate to go to is always baby name statistics. First of all, everybody loves baby names, but also almost every country and even counties, they record the names of newborns, and more importantly, they also publish them. So, but now we have a new problem, because we have now a huge number of baby names. So there's 10,000 of them. So the question is, how do we analyze them? We don't have now only like 38 pots, we have now 100,000 of names. So in here, Alex Bentley and colleagues, they proposed to use or to summarize this kind of data by the so-called progeny distribution. And this distribution records abundances of cultural variants, so in this case names, which produce k new individuals, progeny, over a fixed period of time. So and this progeny distribution looks like that. So these are the kids which have a unique name. So let's say in a 50-year period, these are the poor guys which have a name which only occurs once. Two times, three times, and these are the ones that are called, or these have very common names, so those occur very often. So now, if you want to use this kind of distribution as an inference tool, we of course have to have an idea of what shape should this distribution have under different social learning modes. So we need an idea about those theoretical progeny distributions. And we start with unbiased transmission for the simple reason that this is the only case where we can do some analytics. Everything else we will derive a little bit from simulation frameworks. So in order to derive such a theoretical progeny distribution for unbiased transmission, we use an overlapping birth-death model, something which is usually used or very commonly used in ecology. So the idea here is that the temporal dynamic of those names is governed pretty much by reproduction and competition. So if you were to write down the full interacting version of this system, then we would end up with a very large-scale system of stochastic logical Volterra systems. However, those systems are not analytically tractable. However, the good news is that so-called mean field solutions have been found to those problems, and those mean fields approximation or solutions are very, very good approximations to those systems when we have sufficiently many names. And we don't need to worry about the diversity of names because this is a given. So, and these mean field solutions, the dynamic of these mean field solutions, they are governed by such a master equation. And the important thing about this master equation is this variable p. It gives me the probability that a cultural variance has abundance n conditioned on its age. So it asks how likely it is that a certain cultural variance has accumulated a certain number of progeny over a fixed period of time. So, and the wonderful thing about this equation is it can be solved analytically. And because it can be solved analytically, we can actually write down an expression for our theoretical progeny distribution under unbiased transmission. So, and this distribution has this form. We don't care about the mathematics. So this gives me the probability that a cultural variance really has accumulated k progeny over a relatively long period of time. So the wonderful thing, what we can read from such an analytical representation is that our progeny distribution has a very distinct form. It has a power law, of course everything has a power law, with an exponent of 3 over 2. But then also interestingly, it has an exponential tail off. And this exponential tail off is kind of modulated by the innovation rate. So the higher the innovation rate, the earlier is the onset of this exponential tail off. So this is cool because we have a constant phase, a power law phase, and then we have kind of this exponential tail off, and then where the onset is modulated by the so-called innovation rate. So, and the other wonderful thing about our analytical expression, that in some sense it consists only of this ratio d over b. That means we have only one parameter. So we have one equation, one unknown parameter, so we can actually write down a maximum likelihood estimation for kind of our unknown quantity. So, and this has a very simple form. K total is simply the total number of progeny over our considered time frame, and S is just simply the total number of different names in our time frame. If you know that, that's usually what we simply can count, we can actually estimate the neutral expectation or the expectation of the progeny distribution under unbiased transmission. So now let's apply this to some baby name data. And we applied it to a data set that records the baby names in southern Australia. So left for girls and right for boys. The black line is the empirical distribution, progeny distribution, and the gray line is the maximum likelihood neutral progeny distribution. So it's the best fit under unbiased transmission. So what we see is that, theory and data, they don't match super closely. First of all, unbiased transmission is actually not able to produce the huge amount of singletons seen in the data set, but it's also not able to produce this relatively large tail of very common variants in the population. So if you're interested, the code on how to do that is up on GitHub. And then we ask, what do we need to add? I mean, of course, unbiased transmission is not the likely candidate for explaining such a baby name distribution. And again, we said, what about fashion trends? Because, when you talk about baby names, you all see the fashion cycles that certain names are fashion or popular for a certain time, then they decrease and then they increase again. So what we introduced were selective differences based on the age of the cultural variant. So we assume, again, a pro-novelty selection, where we have a favoring of young variants, so names that have been recently invented, and an anti-novelty selection, so a disadvantage of young variants, and this is a kind of a transmission mode which would favor the persistence of established cultural variants over a long period of time. So, and this is just to show you that if you include those different transmission biases, the shape of the progeny distribution changes. And that's good, because this is what we need. If you want to infer underlying processes from the progeny distribution, we have to have the situation that this distribution is actually sensitive to those underlying processes. So gray is again our neutral progeny distribution. Green is a situation with relatively extreme pro-novelty bias. So we have a lot of low frequency variants because they are selected for, and when they are too old, they run out of fashion. So we also don't have very common names, because you know, old and common goes together, and so in that situation they are selected against. If you have an anti-novelty bias, well, of course, we don't have a lot of these low-frequency variants because again, now they are selected against, but we have a huge number of very, very common names in the population. And again, if my selection strength is kind of becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, those distributions look very, very similar again. But this is not too surprising. This is something which we should expect by now. So when we did this, what we found is that the red line is actually the best fit anti-novelty bias distribution. And so we found actually a pretty good fit between anti-novelty bias and our empirical data. So in some sense, we could say, well, we found a consistency between a preference against new variants in our South Australian data set. So now you might ask, why do we use South Australia? There are much bigger data sets out there. And the reason why we did it is this is the only data set which we could find that was complete, meaning that has all the names, also the rare ones. Because most of the data set, they're incomplete. They only provide the most popular names due to privacy considerations. So they only give you, I think the most common cutoff is 5. So they only give you the name which have occurrences of more than 5 or more than 6. So, and that's two common ways of processing this cultural data, what we at least have found. There are probably more. The first is you look at your whole distribution or time frame you want to publish, and you simply remove all the names which have less than 5 instances in the considered time frame. Or you just take each year and you remove all the year the names which have less than 5 instances in this given year. So now we ask, well, does this thresholding does anything to our ability to infer underlying processes? And the unfortunate answer is it does, and it does very badly. So this is the analysis based on our complete data, where we kind of found some evidence for anti-novelty bias. This is a situation where we just simply applied the total threshold. So we removed all the names which had not accumulated 5 progeny of 5 in our considered time frame. And what you see now is that, well, gray, our maximum likelihood unbiased transmission estimate, and the black line, our empirical estimate, they fit pretty well. So if you just do this analysis based on, you know, without the rare data, all of a sudden we get a pretty good fit between neutral evolution and our data set. But if you applied the year-by-year threshold, it looks again completely different, because now think of the distribution we had before. Now you would say, like, okay, if you compare kind of the maximum likelihood neutral fit with our empirical data, we might actually find some evidence for pro-novelty bias. So, and I think this is a pretty hard lesson to learn, that that there can be situations when the data is incomplete that lead to completely wrong inferences, just because those rare data actually contain a lot of the, well, information about our underlying transmission process or learning processes. So a lot of data are no guarantee for reliable inference result. It might reduce the problem of equifinality, that's for sure, but it might actually also be introduce a lot of new issues you haven't thought about before. If inference is based on the progeny distribution, rare variants are of crucial importance, because analysis based on only the most popular variants can provide misleading evidence about underlying transmission processes. So rare variants, never throw them away, because they actually can contain a lot of information, at least if your aim is to infer underlying processes of social learning. Okay, so just to conclude, can we use population level data to infer a process of social learning? And the answer is like, maybe, a little bit. What I hope I could convince you is that only in the very rare cases you will be able to infer a single underlying process that could have produced the data. So the issue of equifinality is real, and it has to be taken into account when we analyze the data, but also importantly when we interpret our results. But then, what's the value of those inference frameworks? Are they not useless? Should we stop trying to use population level data to kind of solve this inverse problem? And I would say, like, well, there's definitely some values in that. First, as I already said, for me, that we can exclude things as not being consistent with the data, it's success. It's a huge advantage. So we can reduce the pool of potential hypotheses potentially significantly, but we won't be able to pinpoint precisely what it was that actually produced our observed data. What we also can do is we can inform empirical research of what kind of data we would need to collect to achieve a higher inferential power. Now, if they are able to do that, that is on a completely different picture, but at least we can make some suggestion of what would be good to have. But we can also test which statistic or which part of the data is more informative about the question we ask. So in some sense, we should also put a little bit more creativity or maybe more time in kind of developing informative statistic as just opposed to using what's already there, what has already been done in kind of population genetics. And then maybe the last point, understanding whether the oddities of the data introduce a bias inferential results is incredibly important. So in some sense, we can use those mathematical models actually to stress test whether our models are sensitive to the imperfection in the data and kind of what we need to look for when we collect those data. And maybe lastly also, those mathematical models, they help us understanding which processes to influence our ability to detect underlying learning processes. And this is, of course, ongoing research, because all what I have shown so far is kind of incredibly simple models of cultural change. I mean, they haven't included anything complicated, but those things can be included, and then we can ask, like, what happens if there are population bottlenecks? What happens if cultural variants are not independent of each other? What happens to our inferential power? And I think this is all something what we can do with those artificial experiments with those models. Okay, then I reached the end. I thanked my collaborators on those various projects and you for listening.
I might be wrong, but is it correct that you're generally assuming that you have data on the whole population? Big portion of the population?
It depends on what part. So for the progeny distribution, yes, but this is kind of the data that's out there. So this is one of the situations where you actually have a lot of the data. For the archaeological assumption, we only assume that we have a sample, and kind of, you know, we went to the population level first. And with the first, what I generated, I mean, so the simple simulation model, I only have shown you the results where we assume that we have all the information, at least at a single point in time. But we have done exactly the same analysis when we just simply had less information about the population, or even imperfect information.
So, because my question was going to be first, the first part I thought about this. How much does it change your results if you actually only capturing a small proportion of the population?
It changes quite drastically, especially also if your sample is biased as opposed to random sample. And I mean, this is something else with the archaeology example, that we assume that the sampling kind of happened in a random fashion. Of course, you could say, like, well, is it ever, if it's ever random, and what happens if you have kind of, you know, a biased sample? The problem is you can include this into the model. It's just very tough to actually find good reasons to assume what kind of bias the archaeologists implicitly have put in generating those samples. So I can show you some results. We have done some of this analysis, and as you would expect, if you have a bias in the sampling process, I mean, things get even more complicated. But the problem is, especially with the archaeologist finding out what this bias is, it's kind of next to impossible. But at least you can say, like, well, again, if it's if you only excavate in this little corner and by accident you only find those spots, that might, you know, bias your data so much that actually you should stop there. It is a possibility, and there we have to be honest that at some point there are limits to what we can say from this archaeological data.
And then for the last bit, I was thinking of the same question again, but maybe you have kind of large-scale biases in transmissions. For example, looked at South Australian baby names, but I'm pretty sure that you could get some predictors about what's happening in the UK some years before, and that's transmitting to Australia. Whereas actually Australians, well, probably the British don't give a rat's about what people are calling their...
Sure, sure. And I mean, I also want to be very clear. So this is not analysis on how people name their babies. So I don't want to say that there is an anti-novelty bias for each of us. So it's this anti-novelty bias is kind of, it's more like the summary of those individual transmission bias or something which is persistent with or consistent with the data. I mean, choosing the name of a baby, it's so incredibly complex, and everybody knows that they have a different set of preferences, so we won't be able to capture that. But it feels like this anti-novelty bias captures something and kind of disadvantaging this kind of very rare variants, kind of, in some sense, don't allow them to spread, to kind of accumulate progeny. And then if those are kind of filtered out, then the rest is actually behaving kind of more or less kind of almost in a neutral fashion. So, but again, to answer your question, yes, any influence between populations, they're not included in the model. They can be, however, again, it's the question, what kind of influences, how are they, what structure do they have? We had no ideas about those potential influences, so it's just a single one population consideration with kind of ignoring all the influences from the outside. For the first example, we actually have done an N population model where we had migration between them. It was just too much to kind of explain and go through here. We can talk about this later. Yeah.
Baby names a bit. When doing something, so one of the, I guess, interesting things about names is that you have a lot of these situations where you have something like Elizabeth and Elizabeth, where they're basically the same name. I mean, anybody with either of those names will tell you that they're definitely not the same name. But that you have this almost relationship between the similarity or the difference of the names themselves, which could then end up influencing, I guess, things like
that,
similarity bias,
yeah.
Where it's actually, you could almost kind of look at like a looping versus
yeah,
splitting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That changes how people...
Very, very good point. So again, what this kind of models assume is that kind of each variant is almost independent of the other ones. So, and this is again a modeling assumption. Mm-hmm. There is no correlations between those. However, you're right that it's also the question, are there spelling mistakes? So when you write Katie with a Y or with an IE, are these two different names or are they actually the same name? So there's a lot of kind of questions that go into, well, defining almost what's a variant. Because again, we need something what we can count. There's the problem becomes much more dominant in the archaeology example. Kind of, I gave this talk in front of archaeologists, and at some point they started arguing whether this typology is better than another typology, just because they didn't believe that, you know, how you can classify those different motifs. And these are very, very kind of valid discussions. It just says, in order to do those kind of frequency analysis, you need units, you need discrete units, which you can count. And then you do analysis on those frequency. If those units you have defined are wrong, then of course you have a huge issue. So, and you raise a very valid point, and this is kind of what I wanted to say with my last say here. We are not there yet, kind of by including all of that. And I have a student working on kind of the idea of package transmission. So things which are similar, which are correlated, they they kind of are transmitted together. And of course, this will kind of interfere with our ability to detect things because it makes things way more complicated. But I can only leave you for, let's say, another year. We think about those issues at just building the models for that. It just takes a little bit of time because, you know, culture is bloody messy on those kind of things.
So for the archaeological temporal dynamic data, you have, for example, data from time t and data from time t plus one. But I presume most of the archaeological data have uncertainty, you know, when actually, this data.
We only have data at the beginning and then the end of the phase. It's kind of we don't have the whole time series. So we have two data points, and the reason why this is a very extraordinary data set as far as archaeological data sets go, is that A, we have more than one time point, so more than one excavation at the same site, but also there's reason to believe that the difference, I'll tell you a little bit how this is happening. So there were, they found different houses, and those houses were next to each other. And apparently archaeologists know that at that time it was a custom that one generation would build the house next to the older generation. So in some sense, when you know kind of the distribution of the houses, you roughly could say the difference in time between those is generation time. So we actually had pretty good ideas about the temporal kind of time span between observations just for this simple fact. However, if this is not the case, you're right, because the price we pay for using a non-equilibrium model is that we have to have some certainty about the time span. But again, this is something you can include. This is something you can include in your inferential kind of analysis. Well, I would rather include it in uncertainty that, the generative model kind of runs or has kind of different lengths, and we see what it does to the posterior distribution. So that's because we just don't have certainty on that one. Kind of, maybe you can also try to estimate, but maybe I would just simply add this uncertainty into the generative model. But we have done some kind of analysis on that, kind of how much can you screw up your time estimate in order to be totally off? And the answer is, it can actually be pretty big. So the good thing is, it's not conditioned on a year or two, you have to be right. You can actually have quite some substantial fraction of error in that before things go completely down south. They get more inaccurate, don't get me wrong, but it's not that they go completely biased. But it's a good point. This is the price we pay for going from equilibrium to non-equilibrium.
Maybe one last question.
So with your generative modeling, with difficulty completely separating out one possibility, are there any cases where some type of event, like a bottleneck or other disruptive events, or even reminiscent of your first project, a faster rate of change, makes things diverge?
Yeah. The interesting point is, things like the underlying demography, this is a cause of worry, of course, because we can't observe that. But the interesting thing is that those cultural processes, they don't seem to be too affected by things like demographic bottlenecks. So we tried kind of stress testing, we kind of introduced kind of huge bottlenecks in our framework. And again, it makes posterior distributions wider, because as you expect, but it wasn't that it kind of went completely bonkers. But this is definitely one direction we want to go in kind of figuring out what are potentially unobserved demographic events or also cultural events, what we need to look for and that have the ability to kind of completely change our inference results. And those population bottlenecks are one candidate of those. However, kind of preliminary studies have shown if those bottlenecks are not too close to any of our observation points, their influence of our inferential power is actually much smaller than I thought. luckily for those results, but it also means that we can't use this kind of cultural data to infer kind of demography back. So in some sense, it's nice that we don't need to worry about this too much. However, it's of course not nice if you're interested in demography, because that means with this data, well, you can't test those different hypotheses.
She'll be going out to dinner tonight so we can get the conversation, and he's interested.
Thank you.